I am here with Dr. Ken Ferraro from Purdue University. Dr. Ferraro is the director of the Center on Aging and Life course and distinguished professor at Sociology in Purdue University. Dr. Ferraro, would you mind telling us and sharing a little bit about yourself, including some, you know, what you your research interests, how you got in gerontology, what you do, et cetera? Sure.
Well, thanks, Professor Bishop, for having me on. And I have been at Purdue University for over three decades. It was my third job after graduate school. And one of the things that has always intrigued me is the study of aging. I find that there are many ways to study aging, and that's been sort of a lifelong inquiry for myself of how it is that people study aging from so many different angles.
Absolutely. And I know one of the things that you've worked on is this idea or concept of the gerontological imagination. Can you give a little bit more clarity? What is meant by this term or concept? You know, how do you define it? What do you mean by it?
It is, first and foremost, an interdisciplinary specification of how gerontologists think. So when I go to annual meeting of the Gerontological Society of America, I meet people who are biologists and they're working at the molecular level. I meet people who are social workers or policy analysts and a whole slew of disciplines in between. And I've always just been intrigued by, well, how do these people with such apparently disparate intellectual approaches, how do they think about aging? Or alternatively, is there anything that really holds them together intellectually? And so that was the journey of my lifetime, really, in terms of asking that question. I've also been interested in, you know, a number of substantive issues and studied these, but this was sort of a side issue for me that was a slow incubation period. Spent a lot of time thinking about it. And then developed what I call an integrative paradigm of aging. So I'm not a biologist. I don't pretend to be a biologist. I'm a sociologist by training. But what I'm trying to do in the gerontological imagination is specify what are the core perspectives or axioms of what it means to study aging. And so I'm not trying to do just something for social scientists. It's applicable for social science. I'm trying to do it for people who study maybe bats and opossums and dogs, how they age, literally from animal models to human endeavors. So it's really what we would think of as a paradigm or our overall perspective for studying aging. And as I said earlier, it begins with an interdisciplinary specification. So it's not just what sociologists think, but what are the core ideas that really permeate all these fields, even though they're very, very different. You know, one's at the molecular level, another one is at the societal level. Still, there are some things that hold them together.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny to witness into when you're into literature and you go to these talks at GSA and around the globe in the nation, we talk about the same things as social scientists, as biologists. We just term it differently sometimes, you know. So convincing our colleagues to work together and study the same type of phenomenon is great. Now, I know you've done a lot of work in life course research as a sociologist and a social gerontologist, if you don't mind me calling you that. How is the gerontological imagination connected to the human life course?
It's a great question. And I would say that it's integral. Here at my work at Purdue University, one of the colleagues that I've worked with closely for over two decades is a professor in veterinary medicine, and he has a PhD in biology as well as a doctor of veterinary medicine. And I find with him very, very fruitful way of discussing aging because his predominant model is the dog, domesticated animal. And we would talk about things in the period of life for a dog. And I introduced him to the concept of the life course and to help him to think about continuity and discontinuity over time in an animal. And then I think he really, to me one day, he said, you know, the thing that you've really taught me is the whole approach to studying the life course. So instead of just thinking of aging as something that happens when a human reaches 60 or 70 years of age, what we want to do is we want to think about those later years in context with the earlier life. And I suppose that one of the most profound studies that really influenced me was the work of David Barker, mm-hmm. who opened our eyes to the fetal origins of adult health. So for people who are not familiar, lifelong studies, life course studies from literally in utero to later life, tracking the same individuals over time in some studies and other studies linking data, but just seeing the profound impact that fetal malnourishment would have on the development of the individual and affect their risk of disease later in life. This has been shown in multiple continents. There are certainly perturbations or what we could think of as social disruptions that are associated with this. So it may impact a whole cohort of individuals, such as a famine or war, or evacuating children from war, these sorts of things. So that really helped me to see that if you are just studying the later years, that's helpful, yeah. right? But it's a somewhat incomplete picture. And so I think what sociologists and people from a variety of fields, again, biologists, comparative biologists, they're really thinking in terms of the aging process. Sometimes we think too much of the products of the process, right? When we really should be focusing, what are the mechanisms and the pathways by which people have these early exposures and end up with, you know, various risks or perhaps without, you know, some of the nauseous things that we think of for later life. That really helped me a lot, was to understand the gravity or the depth of this in terms of how it would shape truly the life course.
Yeah, it's very, very, that work from Barker is very interesting. I've read a little bit of it, and it's amazing to know that development starts early before birth, and all those diseases, those chronic, and even in your work, you've talked about some health disparities start even early. Can you talk about, in your career studying human aging, what discovery or finding, or perhaps series of findings or discoveries, have intrigued you the most from your own work and help advance, do you think, have advanced our field?
Well, I hope I've made some contributions in a number of ways. Let me just begin with some of my more recently funded research from the National Institute on Aging. I appreciate their support, and it's helped me to understand the childhood experiences that might have an influence on later life health. And I'm not just talking about mental health. I think most of us would understand that it'd be perfectly reasonable that people who experienced abuse or trauma during their childhood years might have mental health outcomes. But I'm really thinking about the physical health outcomes. So in our research, we obviously rely on subject reports of those experiences. That's useful. But we also have incorporated biomarkers into our analyses, one of which is a marker of inflammation. And so what we really see is clear evidence that these instances of childhood misfortune truly get under the skin. They're actually a part of the blood chemistry of the human being. And so that's an important finding from, you know, our point of view. Just related to that program of research, the other thing I noticed when I started studying this was that, you know, there were a lot of people that would say, well, here you've got these adverse childhood experiences, or you've got trauma or some kind of disadvantage. And they'd show it on one outcome. So it's related to, for instance, high blood pressure or heart disease or some such thing. But another study would come along and show it on cancer and what have you. And then, you know, I tried to replicate lots of those studies. And oftentimes I find parallel findings where we would see that it was affecting a really diverse array of diseases, from arthritis to cancer to acute myocardial infarction to, you know, psychiatric problems, et cetera. So, I mean, it's really broad. So thinking about people's health in later years, it is so important to understand the origins, the early origins of these health issues. Not that that solves the problem, right? But at least understanding that helps you to contextualize and to see people who are at risk, and then to think about remediation, if possible, to avoid those risks. Otherwise, people are at risk and they don't know about it.
And just kind of a side question to all that, do you find certain populations are more at risk than others from their experiences in childhood, or that what you call getting under the skin, that kind of from that early point of life and across the life course? Are there certain kind of what you might call disparity kind of groups, I guess?
There are two exposures that really seem to have a pretty strong influence. So some things, maybe they'd be more modest in their impact, but fairly robust findings. Number one, about abuse. So if children were abused in their early life, this influences a lot of different mechanisms, biological processes, and the effects on adult health are notable. And just there are dozens, probably hundreds of studies now that have demonstrated this. Secondly, is socioeconomic status, or thinking of the lower end of the distribution, really poverty. Mm-hmm. So poverty oftentimes is a chronic stressor over a period of time. And even though we'd like to think that maybe it doesn't make such a difference on health, it's very, very strong. So those two stand out. There are others that sometimes have influence maybe on some outcomes rather than others, but child abuse and childhood poverty or financial strain, they really seem to be influencing a wide range of health outcomes.
Yeah, I agree. The child abuse is just so powerful, especially across the life course and into old and very old age too. It still stands strong. Well, a final question is, one of the things that I'm doing with this textbook is really trying to find out from leading experts across the country and the world, how do you define successful aging?
Well, I actually don't like to use the term. And I'll tell you why I don't like to use the term. When Rowan Kahn developed the idea of successful aging, they created a firestorm, really, because the idea of successful aging implies that there's unsuccessful aging. And I rather would disrespect it if you said to me that I was unsuccessfully aging, or if I were to tell you that your mother was unsuccessfully aging. That'd be pretty weird to say about a person that's older than you are, and you're saying that they're unsuccessful in how they're doing it. So I guess I don't like that qualitative sort of categorical, either you are or you aren't. Mm-hmm. Rather, I like to see this in a lot of different shades. Right. And so I view it as more of a continuous thing. What I prefer, what we use at the center in our sort of tagline, is optimal aging. And that means that regardless of the way you define something like successful aging, there's always room to improve the health and well-being of an older person. Right. And so we should not, out of hand, just reject people who have diseases as being somehow unsuccessful in this aging process. The fact that they're alive with the disease shows some degree of resilience in being able to adapt and to overcome it. Some people are actually quite good at managing their diseases and can live a long and fulfilling life. And I feel that there has to be room for those people in our conceptualizations of the good aging or the favorable or the aspirational aging. We cannot dismiss people as unsuccessful simply because they have a disease, which is what Rowan Kahn did, you know, at their very beginning of that development of the idea. So I could see what they were doing and I saw value in what they're doing, but it's the exclusivity of what they did that creates a lot of problems. So again, our center is not called the Center on Successful Aging. I know that lots of my colleagues love to use the term. It's, like I say, it's aspirational, right? You want to be successful. But again, when you start disqualifying people from being successful aging because of a variety of things, that's where the firestorm emerged. So I like optimal aging. I like to think of it in a quantitative term, regardless of where people are, regardless of what diseases they have. If they have something that is impairing their ability to do things, well, to me, let's put the focus on helping them to do those things.
Absolutely.
Or let's put the focus on the prevention of additional declines in function, right? So I think what we really are talking about is function, right? Are people able, and this is a very sociological question, are people able to function in society? So when we think of things like disability, I mean, disability has really two components. It has some component in terms of the body's ability to navigate an environment, but that also means that the environment influences what we depict as disability. So disability is not some intrinsic, inherent state of a human being. It's all relative to their context. So you can see, and we saw this in data in the 1990s and up to about 2010, where there was actually a disability decline among older adults in the United States. That sounds so bizarre to many people. When you say that disability declined among older people, they think you're crazy at first. But there's actually powerful data to show that there were things that have been implemented since the 1980s that have affected the rates of disability. Example, Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA created so many more manageable walking environments and stairs and what have you to enable people to function. So even if the people hadn't changed, the environment changed. And you could think of other things. Look at the boom in orthopedic surgery and joint replacement surgery, where you have individuals who have some degree of impairment in their function. They get this surgery, and not everyone, right? But a good number of them are doing very well after those surgeries. Again, that's what we've got to think of when we think of successful aging. Is it about these diseases that people have or these impairments that people have? Or is it really about helping those people to function at a high level? Let's also face it that the gerontological imagination says that there are these biological components that are critical. And although genes determine only about 25 to 35% of what we know as diseases, still, genes are sort of your potential, right? And then if we have environments and we have behaviors that fit with that potential, then those individuals live long and independent lives. On the other hand, if people have genes that really put them at very high risk of conditions and diseases, we want to think about what are the ways that we help them relative to what cards have been dealt to them.
Yeah, you make some great points there. And one of the other things today with disability you know, the change in the kind of what we see in the populations is this whole emergence too of germ technology and assistive technologies, which allow people to really age in place and function. I just think of a lot of persons I know, and I've come across you, I'm like, I think, how do you live in this home? It wasn't built. It was built way before ADA and all the, you know, it was built, they're very old homes there in this part of the country, in the middle of the country and on the East and West Coast, but you have an older person living there and functioning quite well, thanks to some of these new technologies and other types of assistive types of devices that they can now have access to. It's quite amazing. One of the last questions, I guess, is what advice you've studied, you know, for several decades, aging, what advice would you give individuals, families, or communities just to continue to age well, optimally, in your case?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is we've got to realize that many of us have ageist ideas inculcated in us. And that's one of the axioms of the gerontological imagination. So we have to realize that negative images of older people permeate our society, and they are not only pervasive, but they're pernicious. They are harmful to the individual's development. And then secondly, I would say, rather than think about all of the declines that are recognized that come with senescence, to try to think about ways to beat those odds. Mm-hmm. For individuals as well as for society. One of my former professors told me during graduate school, you know, Ken, our bodies are really overbuilt. We don't actually use all of our brains. We don't actually use all of our physical function that's available. And so people can have some limitations in instrumental activities of daily living and still have a lot of quality of life. Let's look for ways to organize society and to be helpful to older adults so that they can remain independent. That does not mean do everything for them. Older adults need to be challenged. Older adults need to contribute to the social order as well as receive from it, right? And it's an easy mistake, just like a parent with a 3 or 4 year old who wants to help in the kitchen, you might think, well, it's just faster for me to make the meal or make this baked good without the child, but you want to involve the child, right? Older adults, they want to contribute too. They don't just want to get handouts from everyone. They're actually interested in social contributions. So that's what we need to value. We need to value the contributions of older adults to our society.
And I think that is some great advice. I think sometimes we overlook older adults in society. We need more positivity and positive images of our older individuals in our communities and our families. Absolutely.